Now, as you know, the loss of Ennio Morricone, I felt it personally. I felt, obviously, because he's been a part of our programme on Marty in the Morning on RTÉ Lyric FM. In fact, since I joined the station, I'm playing Ennio Morricone all the time. And then to get to meet him and interview him a few times, I just felt this great warmth towards him. And I really felt a sense of personal loss when he died. And I was thrilled to hear from Christopher Frayling, who is ensconced in splendid isolation in the Burren, but a man who knows a lot about Ennio Morricone. Christopher, good morning. Are you still in splendid isolation, Christopher?
That's it. In the heart of the Burren.
The heart of the Burren. What has you here, tell me?
Well, my wife's people come from around Kilcolgan and Kinvara and Oramore. And so we started coming about 40 years ago, built our own house. And it's the most beautiful place in the world. And I thought, when splendid isolation started with the COVID thing, I thought, where better to pull up the drawbridge and get isolated than in the heart of the Burren? And that's exactly what we've done.
Oh, how lovely. You got in touch with us the other day, and we were feeling the pain of the loss of Ennio Morricone. You knew the maestro intimately.
I did indeed. I first met him in 1989, which was the year that Sergio Leone died, very young, aged 60. Yeah. And we were doing a memorial celebration on the BBC Two, and I went to interview him in Rome. And then I decided to write a biography of Leone, because amazingly, in Italy, there'd never been one. Leone was never quite, he wasn't a prophet with honour in his own country, you know. Rather looked down on. Lots of books about Bertolucci and Pasolini and Rossellini, all these people, but absolutely nothing about Leone. So I started that, got to know the family of Leone, who introduced me properly to Ennio, and we got to know each other pretty well.
And your relationship clearly blossomed, because you ended up writing programme notes for the tour. So he obviously held you in very high esteem.
Well, it was interesting, because on the whole, he didn't like talking about Westerns.
You know, no.
He always felt it was lowering the tone. And if ever you met his interpreter, but
yes.
Just before the interview, there was always an orientation session where she would say, if you mention the phrase spaghetti Western, yes, he's going to walk out of the room.
I was told that too.
And spaghetti, he said, is for restaurants. I'm a composer. And I tried to explain to him that it was a term of endearment. You know, I rather like spaghetti Western.
Yes.
But no, he didn't see it like that. He thought it was a real put down. And so, but Leone, he separated from the herd of Westerns. You know, he kind of treated him as something a bit different. So he was quite happy to talk about Leone. And indeed, in the concerts, he always had a suite. Do you remember in Dublin, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly,
one time
in the West, and so on. So he sort of celebrated Leone in his concerts. But no, spaghetti Westerns, it was fun. He once said to me, I only scored 35 Westerns. Why do people talk about Westerns? Only 35.
A very small number.
That's more than Aaron Copland, Jerome Morris, and Elmer Bernstein put together,
Absolutely.
You know? Only 35.
But that was it was fascinating, because we were told that too, and I always remember you would have to kind of skirt into something to do with The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, or whatever it would be, or The Ecstasy of Gold, one of the most beautiful pieces of music, and you would always have to skirt your way into it. When you think about Sergio Leone, of course, and you've written the book, of course, they went to school. They were in the same school together.
Primary school, and there's a restaurant in Trastevere in Rome, which was the suburb of Rome where Leone grew up, where it's called a carrettiere, the carter, the carriage man.
Yes.
And it has traditional, very heavy Roman cuisine, you know, saltimbocca alla romana, which
has
large portions. But on the wall is a photograph of the primary school year of 1935, and there's Morricone in his starched Eton collar, big white collar and a big bow tie, and two people away from him, Leone S. And the proprietor of this restaurant was in that photograph as well. He was at the school at the same time.
That's wonderful.
He arranged a reunion in the late 1980s, just in time before Leone died. And next to this photo in the restaurant are the same people in middle age. And it's the most extraordinary thing. Whenever I go to Rome, I sit and eat at that table underneath those two photographs.
You have to what is the name of the restaurant again, Chris?
Carrettiere, 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 the Carter.
Oh, we have to be there. Trastevere is so beautiful anyway as a place.
It's sort of artisanal, you know, the craft quarter
wonderful.
Of Rome. And yeah.
Wow.
make of the fact that he didn't learn to speak English, and he was quite happy to live in Rome when he could have moved kith and kin off to Hollywood or New York or something. What do you make of that? Was it about pride in the Italian way?
I think he spoke English better than he claimed. Sometimes I'd catch him out where I'd say something
that
actually required quite a knowledge of English to get the joke or whatever it was, and there'd be a twinkle in his eye. So I think, like Leone actually, pretended not to speak English when he actually understood it quite well. I think it was a matter of pride. You know, he once said to me, you know, I've recorded in London, The Mission. I've recorded in Los Angeles, you know, The Untouchables. But I always watch Roma football team on television when I'm away. In other words, my heart belongs to Roma.
Yes. You know?
And I think that's what it was about, really. The other thing about visiting him was that he had this extraordinary apartment on the Piazza Venezia, you know, near that big Victor Emmanuel monument, thing that looks like a giant typewriter in Rome,
yes,
made of marble. And he had a whole floor of this palazzo with a Renaissance tapestry pulled the length of this floor. It was a really beautiful room, but at the end of the room was an iron door with studs on it, this metal door, and he had the key in his pocket, and that's where he worked, and nobody was allowed in. No cleaning lady, no wife, no children, nobody, because he'd have absolutely across the room all his manuscript paper for the scores that he was working on, or the concert pieces that he was working on, and nothing could be touched, nothing could be dusted, and this was the inner sanctum. So I saw the door, but I'm afraid I never got beyond it.
I bought a beautiful book in Turin some years ago, and I think we've seen photographs of the room, but we never obviously got near it, but we've seen photographs of it, and of course he wrote everything pen and ink.
Absolutely, and pencil, actually.
Yeah.
Pencil. I mean, he would... one thing, apart from don't mention spaghetti, the other thing you weren't supposed to mention was to have a photograph of him with your article, whatever it was, seated at the piano, because it created the impression that he composed on a piano, which
yes,
is what most of his colleagues... He absolutely was obsessed with the fact he didn't do that, you know. It came straight out of his head. He would compose by orchestrating as he went along. He'd have 32-stave manuscript paper and a pencil, and the piece would come out. The melody, the orchestration, the use of the musical instruments would all come straight out of his head, first draft. It was formidable, absolutely formidable. And so, you know, he didn't like the idea of sitting at a keyboard because he said, that lowers the tone. It sort of creates the impression I'm a piano man, and I'm not a piano man. It's out of my head. And he said, a lot of my colleagues, you know, they just whistle the tune and send it off to an orchestrator to do the hard work for
yes,
them.
But he, yes,
absolutely everything.
Everything.
Well, you can tell, I think, that strange use of musical instruments and everything is so much part of it that it's obviously part of his composition. So,
and, of course, the singing with no words at all, just noise.
Absolutely. And I once asked him about the roots of his music. Because I'm always struck by the fact that a lot of his scores are choral in different ways. You know,
yes,
you either get a choir or you get a solo soprano, Edda Dell'Osso, you know, that's the ecstasy of
Elvis. Right.
And so on. And he said, well, he thinks that there are two roots, really, for his music. Gregorian chant, he said, is absolutely critical to him. It's the music he loves best. Both for its roots in sort of Hebrew chant and ancient chant, but also for its medieval manifestation. And secondly, now this is extraordinary, for his Western scores, the roots are Celtic, he said.
Celtic?
Yep. That something to do with the chorus and the verse, the sort of texture of the music and the repetitions and so on. He said so a musicologist had written a piece about him where he said the origins of all those Western scores was Celtic music, and he said, I think he's hit the nail on the head.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. And so, I mean, he had a very special regard for coming to Ireland. You know, when
yes,
he came to Dublin a couple of times, came to Belfast, and he scored a movie that people don't really play very much called State of Grace, which is all about Irish-American gangsters, which has an extraordinary scene at the end, which is a kind of showdown during the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York. But it's a rather wonderful score, actually, which is sort of semi-sacred, like a lot of his scores, you know, that you get this feeling that it's on the edge of being sacred music.
Well, he did have great faith, of course.
Absolutely, absolutely. Went to Mass almost every day of his
yes,
life. And as I learned from one of the obituaries, I didn't know this, that he recently did a concert in the Vatican.
He did.
For Pope Francis. And I think he was very close. And of course, the Pope gave a message when Ennio died. So, yes, that was very important to him. He never really talked about that, although The Mission was his I think, his favourite score.
Well, I saw something about him recently where it said he was quoted as saying that he'd only cried twice in his life. Once the first time he saw the mission, and secondly when he met Pope Francis.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, yeah. And in fact, talking about the mission, he was very good on that. He said, you know, it's basically the collision of two kinds of music. One, sort of Palestrina, the music just after the Counter-Reformation, where, you know, papal music is being cleaned up by Palestrina, so there's that going on, and there's the music of the natives in the jungle in South America.
Yes.
And the collision of those two musics, he said, he found profoundly moving, which he's going to win, and does it matter? And, of course, the film finishes with this wonderful image of a broken violin floating down the river, if you
yes.
remember,
yes.
and a little child picks it up.
Yes.
You know, everything else may go, but the music remains.
The music remains. English to you, by the way. I meant to ask you
a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah.
And in fact, when I interviewed him on his 80th birthday about 10 years ago for BBC Radio 4, and at the end of it, he went into English and said, "You have got it wrong. I'm only 65.
No.
And I said, "No, I think you're 80, Ennio." He said, no, all the books have got it wrong. I think you should tell the world that I'm only 65. And so he could tell a joke in English.
That's funny.
But with him, you never knew whether he was being serious or not. I mean, for a moment, I had this adrenaline rush and thought, oh, my God, have I got it wrong?
That's right, yes, for sure.
But it was a gag.
He was quite someone to spend time with, wasn't he, to be in his presence. There was something, I don't want to use the word angelic out of context, but there was something about him, wasn't there?
There was. He didn't have the greatest sense of humour, although that was not a bad joke, but he was rather austere kind of character.
Yes.
Slightly remote, with a sort of aura about him, as you say.
Yeah.
And he always had this, you know, like everybody who's unbelievably successful at something, he always felt that he wasn't rated enough by the music establishment in Rome, that, you know, the serious classical concert musicians didn't really accept him as one of the first 11. And I said, look, come on, Ennio, everybody in the world knows, you're probably the most famous Italian composer,
yes.
Certainly of the late 20th century. And, you know, but he always had this slight feeling, slight edge of they're not taking me seriously. And one of the reasons reasons why you don't mention spaghetti is that he felt it didn't help his reputation to be associated with all these sort of rot gut westerns of the 1960s. And so there was a kind of a little edge to him, which I found quite interesting.
It's funny though, isn't it, when you think about it, Christopher, because it's a bit like the band decrying their earlier hits.
Yes.
And because these pieces of music, I remember when one of the concerts we went to see him at the Three Arena in Dublin, and during the concert, as the opening chords of Ecstasy of Gold started, a man two seats beside me went to his pal, "Here we go." And it was the excitement that he was obviously feeling as this music, that he knew he was going to have the suite.
I completely agree. And even before that, in fact, I introduced Ennio from the stage of the Albert Hall.
Yes.
When he was in his 70s. And I did something a bit naughty, because he'd done a concert at the Barbican where the first half of the concert was this rather difficult string piece that he'd written, not a film piece of film music, but a piece of concert music. And the audience was getting a bit restive because there was about 40 minutes of this, and then came the interval. And just after the interval, opening chords of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and of course the place erupted. They realised they'd come to the right concert after
right.
all. And so I thought, but he never played the earlier ones, Fistful of Dollars and A Few Dollars More, that slight sort of gypsy mariachi music. He started with The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which he turned into a sort of symphonic. Do you remember using clarinets instead of the coyote howl?
That's absolutely right.
And all that sort of thing. And anyway, he was on the stage waiting for the orchestra to begin, and I stood at the microphone and said, "Do you recognise this?" And I tried to whistle bom 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 like this, and he glared at me. I said, "Well, that's the last you're going to hear of that one this evening." But we shook hands, everything was all right. But it's a shame he didn't do those early figures, they're wonderful.
They are wonderful. I was very taken by his presence, though. I really enjoyed just being in the room with him, and the way he'd think carefully about how he'd answer any question.
Oh, very much. Interviews were quite difficult.
Yes.
There was a long pause, which wasn't just translation, where he really reflected, really listened to the question, and really made it a rather serious effort, almost an academic effort to answer. So they didn't flow. You know, they weren't fun and games. He didn't like the celebrity circuit. He never went to film parties,
no.
etc. He was a very serious musician, and really, you know, you felt that when you were in his presence.
But I have to say, equally, when we got to meet him, I had the good fortune that my family were with me in Dublin, and they got to meet him. There was a great warmth about him when he met, when he was introduced to that, "This is your family," and suddenly he seemed to be just a warmth kind of came over him. And
he's a big family man. I had supper with him. In fact, it was in Dublin the night before the concert, one of the concerts, I think the rainy one,
the rainy one
at Kilmainham.
Yes.
And we had an Italian supper the night before, and he loves polenta. He had a lot of polenta, I remember. But there was the extended family, and my family was there. And no, he was a big family man, no questions.
Yes.
That was part of where his heart was.
Do you think you'll write a biography now?
Well, I was thinking about that over the weekend, actually. I mean, there's an interview book which came out.
This is in his own words, too.
In his own words.
Which has only recently been translated to English, I believe.
That's right. It's been around for a while in Italy. And
I couldn't get an English one.
I had to translate it when I was doing something last year. I did a thing on Once Upon a Time in the West last year. And
yes.
I had to use that. Now, there's definitely something there, I think, because it's an interesting life, you know, growing up, learning the trumpet from his father, Mario, playing to the troops in Rome after the Nazis had left in 1944-5 for pennies, you know, playing the trumpet for American and English and Canadian troops, where things were very difficult. Then the big decision in the 50s, do I become a concert, someone who teaches and does a bit of concert music, or do I go commercial? Deciding to go commercial, arranging all those songs in the late 50s. If you've got a Mario Lanza LP, the chances are that Ennio Morricone arranged it, you know. Remember Mario Lanza?
That's right.
In the 50s.
Yeah.
And then in the late 50s, the movies begin, and we're off. It's an interesting life, actually, and it parallels Leone's almost exactly, you know, because they were almost exact contemporaries.
That's right.
Together, and deciding whether to go into the film business, or in Leone's case, would I be a lawyer? Will I do what the family says I should do, get a decent profession? No, I'm going to go into the movies at roughly the same time that Morricone did. So, yeah, they're on parallel lines. There's a story there, definitely.
I think it'd be a wonderful thing to bring out, and I think people are more and more people are beginning to realise not just how fantastic he was, but how influential he was, and the fact that his music was so important for so long.
Yes, and this extraordinary ability he had for, and you were saying earlier that it was almost like losing a member of the family.
Yes.
That a deeply emotional, sort of yearning music. He had this extraordinary ability to get to you with some of those themes. I know your favourite is Deborah's theme.
It is.
And you know, The Mission and so on. They have this sort of nostalgia for something we're not quite sure what it is.
Yes.
But he does yearning without being sentimental, really brilliantly, I think. And that gives people a huge sense of identification with it. It gets to their heart.
It's interesting, and I totally agree with you. It's interesting, however, that he wins the Oscar for Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight,
yes.
Which is, you know, in many ways, very different.
Yes, he gave a very diplomatic answer to you, I noticed, in your interview.
He did.
Where he said, oh, it's a complicated, constructed piece.
Well, I mean, he wasn't wrong.
This is only about 20 minutes of him, and the rest is, you know, bits of The Exorcist number
it's
two
all
and
all
a few
over
other
the shop.
Bits
yeah.
that were lying around. No, I think, I mean, it was so disgraceful he didn't win the Oscar for The Mission.
Of course.
I mean, particularly disgraceful because it was won by Round Midnight, where the score wasn't actually written for the movie. It was all pre-existing music that was put to the film.
Yes.
And so, you know, it wasn't, in that sense, a film score at all for Round Midnight. No, he was really robbed. And he felt that, actually.
He did, yes. He did. He actually kept that. Well, I wish he'd won it for that. Whatever about The Hateful Eight, which was a nice accolade. Well, he's two now, God rest him.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it was two in the end. Is there a favourite piece? Have you got one? Do you know what I found fascinating? Because I started to love him some years ago, I started to explore other things. I have a set at home, Morricone Bossa Nova. All these different styles that he engaged in right throughout the years, and the early jazz stuff. It's really interesting. He's very different.
Yes, and I mean, you probably know he went to a seminar with John Cage in 1958 in Darmstadt, where he says he learnt about, you know, the use of natural sounds, the use of unusual orchestration, the use of long pauses, and the use of silence. And you can see that in all, you know, from then on, from the late 50s, whatever he's doing, whether it's dance music or arranging television music or whatever, there's something slightly quirky use of orchestration, instrumentation, pauses, long, long pauses, and all these things that he picked up from John Cage, the famous seminar, you know, where you have silent music, because it's the noise of the concert hall that becomes the music. You know, the paper rustling, the coughing, the people
yes.
moving their feet.
Yes.
That becomes the music. There's whip cracks, there's incomprehensible lyrics being shouted by a choir.
That's right.
John Cage rides the range, in my opinion.
Well said. I always think when people talk about silence, I always think about Van Morrison, where he says, can you feel the silence?
Yes, exactly. Well, Morricone does that in space. Well, my favourite, The Ecstasy of Gold is one of the, of the more unusual ones.
Yes.
1900. Novecento, the title theme is so beautiful. It's a Bertolucci film of the early 70s.
And he played that constantly on tour.
He did. He obviously loved it. And the other one was, because I got a great answer at interview, in A Fistful of Dynamite, not the main theme, but there's one called The March of the Beggars, which is a strange theme played on a penny whistle, which turns into Mozart's Eine kleine Nacht music, and then you get burping noises.
Yeah.
And I said to him, where did you get that idea? He said, I have a confession to make. I did the burping.
No.
So now it can be told, Ennio Morricone did the burps on The March of the Beggars in The Fistful of Dynamite. I like that one.
He'll be forever remembered now as the burping composer, so well done for that one. Christopher, it's been an absolute joy talking to you this morning. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, me too. It's been lovely.
And thank you for being a listener. I appreciate your presence.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm an avid listener. I tell you, Art on the Burren, Marty in the morning makes us cheer up.
Well, thank you for your kind words, and I look forward to the book. That's the next project
nice
now.
Thought. And I shall say the seed was planted here.
God bless you, and keep the faith.
Okay, bye now.
Take care.
Italy is now open. Fly Ryanair to top holiday destinations such as Naples, Rome, Palermo, Sardinia, and